Hello and welcome to the Promise Institute podcast. I'm Natalie Monsanto, the Institute's Communications and Development Manager. And of course, the Promise Institute is the home for human rights here at the UCLA School of Law. This episode of the show features a conversation between our Executive Director, Kate McIntosh, and visiting professor, Danny Vannucchi. They discuss the latest thinking and how advocacy can affect positive human rights changes and what that means in practice for organizations operating with real-world, pragmatic constraints. If you'd like to see a video of this talk and our growing catalog of others, head over to our Promise Institute YouTube channel. Since you're here now, though, I won't keep you any longer. Here's Kate, kicking things off.
Hi, everyone, and welcome. My name is Kate McIntosh. I'm the Executive Director of the Promise Institute for Human Rights here at UCLA Law. And today I'm delighted to be speaking with Danny Vannucchi about human rights advocacy in the 21st century, emerging trends, challenges, and opportunities for civil society. Today's event is co-sponsored by the David J. Epstein Program in Public Interest Law and Policy at UCLA Law. So Danny Vannucchi has worked in the human rights field for over 15 years, leading campaigns and advocacy work for international NGOs on issues such as torture, corporate accountability, and gender equality. Most recently, he was head of global impact and learning for Amnesty International, helping the organization develop stronger strategies across its movement and better understand its impact. And he also led the development of Amnesty's next global strategy, guiding its work for the next 8 years. This semester, we've been lucky enough to have Danny teaching strategies for successful human rights advocacy at UCLA Law, and I'm delighted to announce breaking news that he'll be offering the class again in the fall. So sign up now. Danny, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, Kate.
So Danny, maybe to start us off, I said that you were the head of impact and learning at Amnesty International, and you were responsible for developing Amnesty's 8-year global strategy. What does that actually mean? What did that work involve?
Yeah, sure. So as head of impact and learning, you know, myself and my team were really leading Amnesty's efforts to evaluate its impact and understand what are the areas where we're seeing progress, what are the areas where we're struggling, and how do we turn that analysis into better strategies, better advocacy initiatives. So as part of that process, Amnesty International, as a big global movement, develops a global strategy, usually every 4 or 5 years, to really try and get the organization to focus its efforts. Obviously, Amnesty works on the whole Universal Declaration of Human Rights, so it's a huge sort of spectrum thematically. So the movement does find helpful to have some direction in terms of where and how to focus. So that's the task that I was leading, and obviously very challenging considering the breadth, not just thematic, but also geographic, right? There's Amnesty, you know, spans across 70 different countries. So it is challenging to find a strategy that, again, allows for that national flexibility, but gives a steer. So that was the work that I was doing. And obviously, strategy work is never something that you do on your own. It's very much a collaborative effort. And for the strategy piece, we worked with really reaching out with a huge amount of partners, funders, activists, to really understand what they thought Amnesty's added value should be, is currently, and what would be some of those areas of focus. So we really focused on three pieces of analysis to guide the strategy. One is the results of these consultations with partners. Obviously, the impact analysis that we did over the last 5 to 10 years. And finally, also doing a little bit of foresight as well and understanding what are some of the trends that we see in the future and how do we need to make decisions now that can help us become a more resilient organization. So that's the work. And we ended up, with the help obviously of the Federation, developing a strategy that, instead of focusing on 4 years, we're looking at a broader time frame, broader time space, so 8 years. and looking at not just the issues that Amnesty was working on, but also how it was working. So not just focusing on the what, but also the how. So what are some of those interventions and capabilities that Amnesty needed to strengthen to become a more effective and relevant organization in the 21st century? The strategy is now actually being finalized through the global governance processes of the Amnesty movement.
We'll come back to talk a little bit about the forecasting and, you know, how you see, where you see advocacy, how you see it needs to develop. But I just want to say, first of all, I'm so encouraged that Amnesty even has that function, because I think the idea of evaluating the impact of human rights work is not something that's necessarily been embedded into human rights organizations for a long time. And it's notoriously difficult to measure impact of human rights organizations, right, or human rights work, because quite often you're trying to make things not happen. And assessing whether you've been successful in that is tricky. So, maybe just how, but were you the first? Did you come in assessing impact? Was that a new thing for Amnesty? How did that develop?
So, I think, first of all, you're right. I mean, I think it is particularly challenging to assess the impact of advocacy work. There's a lot that's been done in the development sector around monitoring evaluation, because, you know, in that case, you know, usually there's service provision, and I think that's more quantifiable. That's sort of easier to understand contribution of the organization. But with advocacy, is definitely more challenging. So I came in the function with a new impact assessment approach for Amnesty, which was really focusing on this methodology called outcome mapping, which is essentially really focusing on identifying the observable changes in behavior or attitude of specific actors that Amnesty was targeting through its advocacy. The reason why that worked particularly well for Amnesty is because advocacy, from a human rights perspective, is actor-based. You know, you're always trying to influence someone, either their behavior or their opinions. So we essentially, what we would do every year is do a whole mapping exercise of what are all the outcomes that our different programs are claiming, based on self-assessment, based on what they can observe, and based on reliable data. And then we would aggregate all of that information to see, okay, what are we seeing here? What patterns are emerging? What are the types of actors that we seem to be influencing more often? Which are the ones that we're struggling with? Do we see any weak signals of change? Do we see any pockets of innovation happening in the corner of the organization? And how can we invest in that? And how can we scale certain pieces of work up? So you can understand how that information was really helpful to then bring back into, you know, innovation more broadly into the organization.
Could you give us a concrete example, Danny? Is it possible to, don't want to put you on the spot, but could you just kind of bring it to life for us, of thinking of one type of impact that you observed or that you might have aimed for and was successful or not successful?
Yeah, I think one of the, you know, most recent analysis that we did, a couple of years ago, was looking, for example, the work around freedom of expression and shrinking civic space, where we were seeing a lot of the impact that we were reporting were relatively small in scale, right? So we're relatively, we were able to support human rights defenders, specific groups of them, pieces of policy, pieces of legislation. So we were seeing some progress there, but we were also getting the feedback that the space was continuing to shrink. So even though we were seeing some small scale results, that wasn't translating into a systemic impact on making civic space sort of, you know, better for human rights advocates and human rights defenders. On the other hand, when we were analyzing work, for example, on economic, social, and cultural rights, or our work on corporate accountability, we were seeing that it was a smaller pool of programmatic work, but the scale of impact was perhaps broader, that we were able to influence policies and laws and communities that were having a ripple effect on broader into society and was setting precedent for further improvement. So that was really an interesting observation to think about, okay, how can we then really scale up our work on freedom of expression? What else do we need to hit that piece of work to make sure that our work become more systemic? While on economic, social, and cultural rights and corporate accountability, how do we do more of that? You know, if we are seeing that our work is maybe smaller in terms of the quantity that we do of it, but is having a more, achieving more systemic impact, how do we scale that up? So I don't know whether that's helpful, but that's the type of analysis that we're really always trying to emerge. Or for example, that, you know, we would find corporate actors in a way almost more susceptible to the traditional naming and shaming approach that some governments, and this is something, I mean, this is a huge piece of conversation for us looking forward, you know, how does the naming and shaming approach transform in the 21st century, and how, you know, we've noticed, again, through our impact analysis, that it's becoming harder to raise the political cost of a human rights violation when it comes to governments, especially certain authoritarian governments, while I don't want to say it's becoming easier, but it's definitely easier to attack the reputation of companies by exposing the violations that they are conducting, right?
Interesting. Does that mean that you would look for corporate influence in new areas? So, for example, in the freedom of expression area, would you see whether there were some corporate actors that you could work on and anticipate that might expand the space in ways that were more productive?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that is one of the key shifts, I would say, that the organization is looking into is, you know, when it comes to developing advocacy work, you know, human rights organizations have been primarily state-centric, right? So looking at the state apparatus, who's responsible for taking certain decisions and how do you break down that decision-making process, but actually acknowledging that we have to map out the broader system of influence, and corporate actors have a huge role to play there, negative and positive in some cases. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. That corporate actors are so influential that we can't consider corporate accountability as a niche issue. Actually, we have to look at corporate actors throughout all of our portfolio and looking at better understanding their impact, their influence, and their structure as well. And that means investing in new types of expertise and new types of legal challenges that might come with it when you try and take on big corporate actors.
That's fascinating. So that leads me to the big question I wanted to put to you, which is what you see as the main challenges facing big human rights INGOs like Amnesty International today. And I feel like you've already set out that maybe there's these new actors on the scene, but perhaps you could just talk to us generally about sort of from the big INGOs perspective, what are the challenges?
Yeah, I mean, I think as I've already said, you know, I think that the rise of corporate influence and how do we deal with that, I think it's a symptom of a bigger issue, which it's not necessarily a bad thing, but, you know, we're seeing that the human rights movement, it's become an ecosystem, right? The ecosystem is much more diverse. We're seeing obviously organizations in the global south becoming much stronger and much more present, not just in their country, but globally. We're seeing corporate actors, you know, also entering the space of human rights advocacy. You know, we're seeing even these days, you know, corporates really taking also in some cases a positive lobbying approach to human rights. And we're seeing, you know, grassroots movements, you know, really dominating the space of human rights advocacy, which is fantastic, which is great. You know, it means there are more actors that are really trying to achieve change. But from the perspective of an international NGO, this poses the question, what is the added value of these big organizations like Amnesty? And I think the case of grassroots movements is particularly telling. You know, we've seen in the past 10 years, really huge excitement in people power movements, taking the streets and really being able to shape conversations on human rights from, you know, all the way from the Arab Spring to, you know, protests in Hong Kong and Thailand and Chile to protests in the US about police brutality. You know, maybe in the 60s when Amnesty was created, you know, it definitely thought itself as a people power movement, and it still is, but it is nothing compared to these movements that we've seen organically developing on the street, these leaderless movements. So the question is, again, what is the added value there? And the consultation that we ran with these partners was really helpful to try and understand, you know, what does effective solidarity mean nowadays for these grassroots movements? And it's understanding, for example, that framing an issue as a human rights issue is actually really helpful. And we've seen that even from our own learning experience, from the work that we were doing, for example, in Ireland and Argentina around abortion, where we were trying to decriminalize abortion in both countries, and Amnesty was entering, you know, essentially a partnership with these really powerful people power movements. And what Amnesty was able to contribute to these movements wasn't necessarily getting people out in the streets, but it was being able to provide the human rights analysis, you know, being able to frame abortion as a human rights issue, being sort of the legal and thematic experts on something, but also being able to support activists, you know, when if there are some issues in when protests are happening, being there on the ground, being able to research, you know, police brutality and so on. So that's definitely kind of one challenge, and we can talk about the different different solutions there. But the other element is something that I've mentioned already, which, you know, is we can't forget the original theory of change of the international human rights movement, which is really based on naming and shaming and the, you know, this the boomerang effect approach, right? The fact that you'd have organizations in the global south appealing to these big NGOs so that they would be able to spread the word of the abuses happening in those countries, bring those issues to influential foreign governments, international organizations, so that they could themselves put pressure back onto the violating country. And we're seeing that model not functioning as effectively as it used to. And there's different several reasons for that. But first of all, obviously, the geopolitical order of the world is changing drastically, and we're seeing less countries being able to stand up for human rights globally. And, you know, that's been a huge blow to that. But on the other hand, you know, a government like China is becoming much more proactive in undermining human rights as international human as an international legal framework. So that is a, you know, that is a huge challenge. And on top of that, you know, we have some leaders who cannot be shamed. You know, the naming and shaming, it becomes harder when you have some shameless leaders, right? So this is a huge challenge. And again, that doesn't mean that naming and shaming doesn't work any longer. It just means that we need to be much more selective on when and how to really engage in this. So again, just to summarize, I'd say, you know, really the naming and shaming and boomerang effect becoming less relevant because mm-hmm. of geopolitical effects, the rise of corporate power, and how do we really wrestle with that, and a bigger ecosystem and especially grassroots movement, how do big NGOs support grassroots movements?
You talked about deliberate attacks on the legitimacy of the human rights framework, and you talked about shameless leaders. You also mentioned less countries being able to stand up for human rights globally. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think, you know, usually our allies of our, you know, NGOs, you know, we would find them in Europe, we would find them in the US, you know, and we would be able to really strike a strong partnership in raising certain issues at the United Nations or raising issues bilaterally with certain governments or when they deal with aid or development. And we're seeing that governments are less open to do that. And I think that you know, has to do perhaps with other interests coming in, you know, with certain governments. You know, we've certainly seen that, you know, after 9/11, you know, there was, you know, a lot of interest in these governments to actually promote security over human rights, and that you weren't able to do both. Competing interests, I think, in these governments. And we've seen that with the refugee crisis as well. You know, obviously, when we were trying to, you know, really try and get some progress on, you know, numbers of refugees accepted, we would usually go to our usual allies on this. But in fact, it was the European governments that were striking problematic deals with some countries of origin. And obviously, we've seen in the United States under Trump, that's definitely undermined the US's ability to be to speaking, you know, confidently about human rights in the world. But also because these governments who had been traditional human rights, you know, champions have themselves also engaged in serious human rights abuses, they also become less credible to other governments, right? Why are you coming to me to tell me to fix my human rights record when, you know, you have your own issues? So you see, when a government like China approaches, a government with no strings attached development, that becomes really, a really appealing proposition for a government that might be engaging into human rights violations and just wants to receive, you know, aid or support without tying it to improving their human rights condition.
Got it. So given this new environment ecosystem, these forces you're talking about, what do the big international NGOs like Amnesty need to do to adapt and be effective?
Well, I mean, I think going back to the ecosystem is, first of all, understanding what their added value is and how they can really support other movements and other partners. I mean, this has been an ongoing issue. I think, you know, it's not just particular of now. You know, it's always been a question: how does Amnesty and other NGOs become more effective partners? But I think the question is becoming more and more pressing, and understanding that, you know, big NGOs need to really share power and need to share space. Seeing and building on the feedback that we received is, for example, understanding that, you know, movements and partners find helpful to leverage the credibility and the reputation of big organizations like Amnesty to, for example, have access to the United Nations or access to centers of power, which normally smaller organizations wouldn't have access to. So really leaning into that and leaning into the fact that sometimes NGOs need to really take a step back and disappear. You know, one of the biggest challenges is, you know, when Amnesty joins partnership with local NGOs and there's a public statement that's put together, and what the media will pick up is Amnesty International and other organizations say X, Y, and Z, you know, and that's a challenge, and learning how to really be able to take a step back to almost become invisible in some of those partnerships. And, you know, it's hard for an organization that's so big and has such a strong brand. So that's something that there's definitely work that needs to be done. But a big piece of work and a big shift that we're seeing in NGOs is really changing the way that we communicate and talk about human rights. This is not a new challenge. But what we're seeing is that we're talking about this in a much more comprehensive way, that it's not just about getting your message out. It's actually about complementing legislative and policy change with changing the narrative that exists out there. And that will require big changes in the way that we talk about human rights, you know, being much more value-based and being hope-based as well. You know, I can talk more about this because there's so much about this piece of work. But if we're looking at some of the governments that, you know, where authoritarian leaders have been able to really take root and you know, gather huge political support, has usually been because they've been able to establish a narrative based on fear, based on crisis, conflict, these frames that have become really effective. And that's put INGOs and organizations like Amnesty on the defense, right? Being able to say, no, that's not the narrative that we want to see. Human rights defenders are not criminals. And actually, what we weren't realizing is that we were actually reinforcing those narratives by playing by the rules. Refugees are not coming here to take over your work and becoming criminals. So that's really made us think a little bit more about why don't we do a better job of actually articulating what we're for, not what we're against. Can we create, instead of fighting someone else's narrative, how can we create our own narrative of what does a world look like when human rights have been upheld? And making that very clear, making that very tangible as well, for especially for those persuadable. So really the idea is to, and there's also a lot of neuroscience analysis out there that says that actually using a frame of fear and danger makes people more conservative and defensive, right? And actually telling people that they're wrong can actually reinforce their opinions if it conflicts with their beliefs and values. So how do we change those values and their beliefs? How can we use talking about values that can bring us close to a different audience rather than alienating it? An example of this, just to briefly mention, is the work, for example, on marriage equality in the US, in fact, where after much audience analysis and focus groups, the campaigners shifted from a language of rights and gay rights and rights of LGBT people to a language of focusing on marriage, focusing on freedom to marry, focusing on love. And that was incredibly effective to bring over people from the other side of the aisle. And we've seen that with other, we've tried to experiment as well on that with work on refugees, work on human rights defenders. I can tell a lot more about this, but focusing on value-based and hope-based communications is definitely something that we're seeing much more of that happening in INGOs.
So I think this is absolutely fascinating. And so many things are coming into my mind from sort of legal drafting point that you never repeat your opponent's argument, for example, like the number of briefs I've been through and just crossed out the headings, like don't repeat the argument, you know, just put your own vision forward. But to the way that I hear you talking about human rights organizations understanding the power of storytelling and controlling the narrative, and makes me think that this is exactly, you know, going for the much larger systemic change perhaps that you were referring to earlier. So instead of looking at isolated incidents and laws and people whose rights have been violated, you're really looking at shifting an understanding, which I think has the possibility to have much wider impact, right? And I mean, it would be great to hear some of your examples, but I also wonder, I mean, is this an uncontroversial approach? Because it also sounds, you know, I wonder how does the human rights sector feel about sort of wholeheartedly embracing PR? Because it's kind of like, let's watch the advertisers and learn from them, right? And on one level, I think whatever works, works. But are there any misgivings about kind of integrity or manipulation? I mean, is that in there somewhere?
Yes, for sure. I mean, I think this is controversial to an extent, but you know, I think if we were making everybody happy, I think we wouldn't be doing our job. I think as strategists, I think we're always trying to push the envelope. I think there's perhaps the misconception that if you are talking about values, that you're doing that over rights, that obviously is making a lot of people very uncomfortable, meaning, oh, does that mean that we cannot talk about human rights anymore? That's obviously not the case. And I think there will always be spaces where the legal language and the more technical approach and talking about rights works. But we need to really try and change the way that that we appeal to different audiences. And again, because of a lot of the analysis and the focus work that we've done, unfortunately, you know, especially in Europe and perhaps in the States, language around rights is usually associated with the protection of minorities, which obviously, I mean, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but that means that there is a portion of society that doesn't see human rights as something that can really benefit everybody, you know? And I think this has been perhaps been a fault of NGOs as well. But I think there's also an opportunity in talking about solutions rather than always talking about, you know, the problems. And again, you know, that is in itself controversial because we always want to be fact-based as organizations. That is not to say that we shouldn't be well researched in everything that we do. I mean, that should definitely be the case. But when talking about what are some of the solutions that we want to campaign for versus what we are against, that is also to an extent making some people uncomfortable. And just as an example, one of the things that Amnesty was working on was looking at the human rights impact of policies of austerity, right? And how that was impacting on the right to health, for example, in certain countries. And the whole campaign was framed around, we are against austerity as a policy. But then the question was, but if we're against austerity, but what are we for? What is the alternative? And that was pushing really our policy experts to think, okay, what is it? Is it universal basic income? Is it tax reform? So it you can see how it's taking policy development in new directions. But, you know, I think that's exciting, you know. But, you know, there are some advocates that think that's not necessarily the role of NGOs. You know, that's the role of governments to figure out what the taxing system is. And but I would say, you know, I think for NGOs to remain relevant, you know, we should try and bring solutions to the table, you know, and that will need creative policy development to an extent.
Super interesting, yeah. And I can already see the tension there between people who think that international law provides some kind of potentially politically neutral framework and those who have an understanding that it will always have these, you know, very political consequences. I want to open it up soon to questions from our audience, but before I do that, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the class you've been teaching at UCLA Law this semester.
Yeah, sure. It's been really exciting, and I've really hugely enjoyed that. What we're basically doing in the class is we are looking at the different components of the different steps that we have to go through to develop an advocacy strategy, a campaign strategy. So it is part seminar and part workshop, right? So what we'll do every week is we'll look at a specific component of an advocacy strategy. So it could be how you develop your targets, how you analyze your problem, how you select your tactics, how you do communications. And we'll look at examples and case studies from human rights campaigns from around the world, trying to understand what were the decisions that they took, what worked, what didn't work, so really reflecting on learning from other campaigns and other examples. And then in the workshop portion of the class, the students are actually developing their own advocacy strategy. So they're putting into practice some of the tools and the methodology that they will have discussed, how other organizations have have used them. So it's a very, very hands-on, very practical approach. And it's really trying to bring the students behind the scenes on what it means to develop an advocacy strategy and what are the sort of decisions that you will be called upon to make. And sometimes they're tough decisions when you have to decide over a certain tactics over another, or a certain country over another, or a case over another. So to really try and understand how all these decisions can help you achieve your objective. And for this semester, the students are focusing their advocacy strategies on protecting environmental human rights defenders. So it's been really interesting to see how they've had a go at it. So that's the course.
I know that we discussed how the students that have signed up for your class this semester have not necessarily identified themselves as students that are interested in international human rights. And that was something that we were very conscious of when we advertised the course, like these advocacy tools can be used in a wide range of situations. Could you talk a little bit about how that's worked, introducing your international human rights advocacy framework to projects that were perhaps from other sorts of social justice movements or beyond?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what's really enriched the class and the conversations is, you know, there's obviously some students that are very familiar with the human rights frameworks, but others that are coming quite fresh to it and maybe coming at it from a more social justice perspective, from an environmental justice perspective. And the reason why that's really interesting, because that's actually reflects more the reality as well, right? That the best strategies really are the ones that are developed in a truly multidisciplinary way, where you're bringing in people from different fields. You bring communicators, you bring neuroscience, you bring environmental experts. So, you know, having just human rights experts develop, you know, advocacy strategies, you know, can be limiting, right? So throughout the course, I think it's been really great to see that exchange and how people are approaching, you know, the conversation without the usual frames that may come with someone who's been more apt to the human rights language and the human rights institutions as well. And it's also, we're trying to understand, I think I'm trying to talk to the students about, you know, what it means to work within the human rights framework, right? So you just need to know what that means. You don't need to necessarily be a legal expert. I mean, myself, I'm not a lawyer, right? So it's important to understand what international human rights law is and how it may affect the strategy, but you don't need to be necessarily a legal expert to develop that journey and that advocacy strategy.
And how has the experience of teaching been enriching for you personally?
It's been great. It's been really great. It's really allowed me to sort of take a step back and first of all think about all the different, you know, approaches and methodologies and campaigns that are out there that people might not really know about, because I think a lot of this really happens behind closed doors, I think, in NGOs and how advocacy is developed. So it's really made me think about what would be helpful to share. And something else that I've also been able to really learn from you know, reminded from the students is that with advocacy, it's not about black or white. There's always going to be something that works better in a specific context. And I think the students themselves in the conversations were saying, yes, sure, you know, let's go for a hope-based communication, but I'm sure there are cases in which naming and shaming still works. And in fact, that absolutely, there's never a definitive answer when it comes to advocacy and strategy. And with in the format of the seminar, that nuance comes up. You know, it's always trying to understand, okay, but when does this approach actually work, something that might be considered as traditional. It doesn't mean that it's completely off the shelf. It can still be helpful. So let's try and discuss when that happens. And I think it's been really great to see that coming from the students.
Great. Okay, I want to invite the participants to, if you could raise your hand if you'd like to ask Danny a question. And maybe while people are thinking about what they want to ask, I can just ask you to talk a little bit more about the neuroscience. I'm just fascinated by your references to that. Can you tell us a little more about what that has to offer?
It's really interesting just looking at how does the brain actually work, right? And what's some of the things that, again, have come through is that, you know, using negative frames around anger and crisis and conflict actually activates the defensive part of your brain. So it doesn't necessarily lead to the creation of empathy, right? Or which is always what we're trying to do, is get people to empathize with victims or those that are at risks or rights holders. But I've also found, you know, really fascinating learnings around the fact that, for example, when you're trying to really get someone to empathize with a different group, that what seems to be more effective than anything else is seeing someone from your own community empathize with someone with a certain minority group, right, or a certain group. So looking at rather than, you know, hearing the story directly from the right holder or the victim, so to speak. So that's been really interesting to think about. How do you then bring in more of that? How do you bring in the audience that you're trying to convince into your communications? One of the most successful videos that Amnesty International did in the last couple of years was a very simple video where you had, I think we shot it in Poland, where it was Polish people just sitting face to face with a refugee and just creating that connection. And it was seeing people of their own community, of their own Polish community, empathize with refugees that really resonated to bringing people along to our side. So that's fascinating. And there's also a lot of work and analysis. There's this great author called Anat Shankar Osario that's done a lot of work around the use of language around rights and how we can talk about it in a much more proactive way, and talking about human rights as a tool rather than as like a passive concept. So there's a lot there that can really help activate, again, positive frames in people and activate the empathy part of people's brains. So there's a lot of research out there. And yes, working more with neurosciences is something that INGOs have started to do.
That's really fascinating. Perhaps I could just ask you to reflect as well in closing about whether you're optimistic about the future and effectiveness of the big INGOs. I mean, you talked about all the shifts in ecosystems and the effectiveness of grassroots movements and these leaderless movements that are really driving change. Do you think there is still a role for the big INGOs? Are they adapting in the way that they need to?
I mean, I'm an optimist, and I want to think that there is a role there. Absolutely. You know, I think the challenge is balancing out the need to innovate with the need of to focus on what INGOs are good at. And they need to do a little bit of both, you know. And I think there is definitely the driver to if there's a new issue, to jump on it, to always expand the remit and expand the thematic portfolio. And I think that's a big risk, you know, as NGOs are trying to stay relevant. To try and always jump on whatever bandwagon is there at the moment, or whatever crisis exists right now. But actually balancing that with, okay, let's really understand what we're good at and stick with it. And really hearing from allies in these movements. I do think there is, again, an added value. That's what we're hearing from partners and grassroots movements as well. It will require, I think, INGOs to, in some cases, take a step back. In some cases, do less, but do it better. But I think there is still a role there. And I don't think the change is going to happen overnight. You know, these big organizations take a while to change. But I am definitely encouraged to see the direction that these organizations have been taken. It's not just Amnesty. A lot of organizations have been going through big strategy processes. You know, Oxfam has just released its 10-year strategy, Transparency International as well, CARE International. There seems to be a moment where big organizations are really looking at strategy and acknowledging that it's really, I'm encouraged to see that all of these organizations are looking at systemic change. They're understanding that they're part of a system and that we can't just look at the symptoms, but we have to look at the root causes of human rights abuses, and making sure that we all, do our part in challenging those systems.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was going to ask whether this is a general thing. It's not just Amnesty that's having these conversations. Of course, it's an awareness that's sweeping across the sector. Okay, I have a question from Kathy Sweetside. Would you like to jump in?
I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about reaching a consensus about solutions. It sounds like from what you're saying that it's a little more tricky with solutions than with just saying identifying rights violations can be relatively straightforward to reach consensus on, but then, you know, the preferred solution to that could be difficult. So what kinds of mechanisms would you have for, if people disagree about the solution, how do you resolve that?
Well, I think that's a great question. And I think developing solution-based policies, I think it's definitely something that, you know, NGOs are, you know, human rights organizations should be working more towards. I think, you know, and this actually could be one of the interesting added values of big global NGOs is looking at analyzing best practices from across the world. So, you know, to an extent, you know, it's not necessarily that an organization like, you know, an NGO needs to come up with a new policy, but what it can do is to analyze really when that's worked in other contexts, in other countries. So you take universal basic income, for example, which is one of the issues around, you know, how do you fight austerity? You know, you could look at, you know, how that's been done around the world, you know, and looking at the pros and the cons. To me, that's what solidarity today looks like, is really trying to learn from the experiences and policy experiences of other countries. There's a little bit of pushback on that as well, because you can see that there is, every time you start talking about best practices, you know, governments then start to say, oh, see, that's the way of doing it. And there, you can adopt a good policy, but still end up, you know, having adverse impacts on human rights. So, but I think we should be more open, and organizations should be more open to compare different policies and the success of different policies from different countries. Austerity is around economic, social, and cultural rights, but even on more traditional issues like, you know, torture, for example, you know, I think there's a lot more policy solutions out there around what does it take to, what does it take to prevent torture, or what does it take to prevent police brutality? So developing human rights research that's more comparative as well from a policy perspective can really help us identify the best policy solutions. So see, that's more positively framed rather than, well, this doesn't work, right? Another example that I think is really interesting is when it comes to human rights due diligence with companies, right? So, you know, we always say in the work on corporate accountability, multinational corporations need to conduct human rights due diligence to understand what the impacts may be of their operations in human rights. But then often organizations don't go, NGOs don't, and civil society don't go to the detail of saying, but how should this human rights due diligence be conducted? Be specific, right? So really pushing yourself a little bit more in that realm. There's some organizations that do it, but some that are a bit more hesitant to really spell out exactly the steps that a government or a corporation want to see.
It's more difficult, right? It's harder.
Yeah, it is difficult. And also, especially with the corporate world, you don't want to end up having some sort of, this is the template to do a human rights due diligence thing. So this is the amnesty template. We'll use it, so we'll be fine. No, you know, you might end up still, you know, having, you know, adverse human rights impacts, and the company can turn around and say, oh, but we've used your, you know, human rights due diligence approach, you know, and yet we're still seeing sadly. So you see that it is, you know, that it is challenging.
You become complicit if potentially. Yeah. Okay, I have a couple of questions. Coming up from Brady Mabe, one of our students. Brady asks, has Amnesty had any success in finding new partners on the international stage now that the US and Europe are less helpful? Is there any move towards identifying specific strategic partners based on individual campaigns?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Brady. And I think an interesting approach that we've taken is actually in understanding, for example, trying to better understand China's foreign relations and how that is impacting countries in, for example, in Africa and in the Philippines. So how can we actually work with those governments? How can we work with the Philippines? How can we work with Cameroon, you know, to try and then put pressure on their own government so that they can put pressure on the Chinese government when they come in, you know, invest in infrastructure projects, for example, in their country. So it's less of a boomerang effect, but it's more working with, I wouldn't say they're not traditional partners, but it's certainly rethinking the boomerang effect and how do we work with directly with those governments, like, you know, governments in Africa or governments in the Philippines that are supportive of human rights, and how do we support them to better, you know, to have a human rights compliant relationship with the Chinese government, for example. And if I think of others, I'll think about it. I'm sure there's more.
Thanks. Have Jessica Lauro or Lauro.
Hi, Jessica Lauro, and thank you so much for this. My question is, what is your advice for, you know, a new lawyer, young professionals getting into this field? Where did you start? Where do you suggest that we start now?
Yeah, thanks, Jessica, for the question. I think it's what I find always quite interesting about sort of strategy development is that that's something that is not an obvious career trajectory when you come into civil society. It's something that you're expected to sort of learn how to do, you know, when you get to things strategically, how to get into the organization, into organizations. And this was also one of the impetus to create this course, right? Is to kind of support that the development of that skill and that muscle before entering the workforce of civil society. You know, I think for me, what's been helpful for me is certainly trying to understand the different types of work that exist in an NGO. You know, I think there's, you know, people might think, oh, you know, the obvious route is being a researcher or being a legal advisor, but there's actually quite a lot of functions inside an organization, right? So that really contribute to strategy. You can be, you know, a campaigner, you can be a communicator, you can do marketing. So kind of really understand what do those different functions do and what you think fits your personal inclination more is something that, you know, it worked for me. You know, when I joined, you know, Amnesty as an intern, really, I realized early on that I didn't want to focus on research, on sort of exposing human rights violations. And I was much more of a doer, and I was much more, okay, how do we solve this? How do we develop a strategy, right? And that's, and I kind of made my way into that. So that's, I mean, I don't know if that's particularly helpful advice. You know, what I would say is, again, try and I don't think there is one path, and I don't think there is one, one type of role as well that exists working in an NGO. There are so many different ones, and trying to find out which one works best for you is usually the first step, I would say.
Can I ask Danny, Justin, would you think that some sort of understanding and awareness around storytelling and communications is sort of essential for all of us now? Or can we still separate, you know, I'm the researcher, I do the legal strategy, and I find somebody who's a communications expert? I mean, from our perspective as a law school, I think this is a really interesting question for us to think about. What skills do we need to give our students?
Yeah, I certainly think an awareness of that, I think, is important. I mean, not everybody needs to be a kind of skilled communicator, you know, or a PR machine, you know, but certainly being aware of the different ways that you can convey your message, depending on who your audience is essential. And I think it's also breaking down the way that this usually is talked about is that you've got the legal way of saying things, and then you just have to dumb it down you know, for certain audiences. It's much more complicated than that. And it's much more sophisticated than that. There's also an assumption that decision makers are a technical audience. And I think we're increasingly seeing that that's actually not the case. You know, a lot of parliamentarians and a lot of policymakers, a lot of leaders are not experts and don't, you know, any longer, you know, so they don't really understand that, that the technical language any longer. So it's certainly becoming more of a tall order for people to understand at least what's at stake in the different approaches that exist.
I'd like to thank everyone for coming. I don't know if you want to leave us with how you would advise those of us that are engaged in trying to bring about positive social change to think about our work, but just leave you with a last moment for some closing thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, again, thanks, Kate, for this opportunity and for the opportunity of teaching the course as well. It's been really interesting, and it was definitely, you know, inspiring for me to be able to take the time to look at what campaigns are out there and what exciting work organizations are doing. And that is something, as we're talking about hope and we're talking about, you know, being hopeful for the future, that's something that I encourage everybody to do. Just look out at the incredible work that's being done by a lot of organizations, some of them sort of grassroots movements who are really, you know, changing the debate and changing the narrative and being inspired by those victories. I think it's something that we don't do well enough, I think, as a movement. And also coming from the monitoring and evaluation perspective, you know, people always tell to me, oh, but, you know, if people self-assess impact, you know, isn't there a bias, you know, a kind of a, people are going to always overclaim things. But trust me, you know, in the human rights world, people don't overclaim, they will always underclaim. You know, there is definitely a negative bias in terms of, you know, even if a victory or you know, an objective is achieved, you know, advocates always look at the next step. Okay, great, but this is not enough. What's the next thing? What's the next problem? And let's really celebrate the successes that organizations and movements have achieved. And let's let ourselves be inspired by those and learn from those as well. So again, closing on a positive note and taking the time to seek those stories out and to try and understand how they got there. And and apply that to whatever work it is that you're doing.
Fantastic, Danny. Thank you so much. And thank you to everyone for joining us today. Have a great rest of your day, everyone. Bye-bye.
If you agree there should be more human rights lawyers in the world, which is to say, more superheroes in the world, then there's a simple way for you to help donate to our programs and initiatives. We do everything from support graduates being placed in jobs to broadening their skill sets and perspectives with talks like the one you just heard and much, much more. Visit law.ucla.edu/support-promise. And thank you. All right, other housekeeping. Be sure you're subscribed to the show. Follow us on social. We are at Promise Inst, INST, UCLA. And tell a friend about us. Till next time, take care.